are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, December 13th, December 12th, excuse me. It is Monday, December 12th. 2016. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday on the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Professor Shelley Rigger of Davidson College on Taiwan, China, the global significance of Taiwan, China's posture towards Taiwan, and America's delicate balance that might just be getting disrupted and destroyed by the orange menace. Also, the head of Exxon is headed to run the State Department. Apparently, we're cutting out even the semblance of a foreign policy independent of Exxon. Exxon, a company so ruthless in its global hunt for energy that it even undermined programs that the Bush administration put in place to benefit local populations. We'll talk about that. More evidence that Russia interfered with the election as all sides in the debate get dumber and dumber. That's just what happens when Russia comes up. Everybody gets more dumb. But we will talk about the energy angle and the convergence of interests between an Exxon world and a Putin world. The alt-right, neo-Nazis, losers, and men's rights activists or whatever, various other really important people, have discovered something really upsetting. Star Wars is not particularly friendly to their worldview, and they are upset. They're focusing on the big issues, along with various YouTube personalities that are still putting out nonsense about safe spaces when global neo-fascism is winning across the United States and Europe. Sounds really smart to me. And there's an answer for the march of global neo-fascism, and that answer comes from a glib, charismatic, mind-expandingly corrupt former British Prime Minister. That's right, my old friend Tony Blair, touring the United States, saying that we need a new radical center. We need a new politics that is about getting things done, like invading Iraq and dipping in Rupert Murdoch's wife's DMs, if you know what I'm saying. That and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Let's start, do some sound. You guys ready to do some sound up top? Okay, so this is an interesting sort of question here. We know that there was one theory before the election that if we elected a orange-faced clown fascist and handed control of the federal government to a radical, intransigent, corporate bagman Republican Party, that somehow that would reverse jujitsu, benefit the left in America. And one of the ways that that would benefit the left would be that it would clean house in the Democratic Party. Now, it looks like the Democratic Party is in some ways getting it. Keith Ellison's a good pick for DNC chair, and Chuck Schumer has opportunistically come right out to say that Bernie Sanders nailed it. But it's not as if the Democratic Party is having a wholesale makeover. And frankly, if they did have a wholesale makeover just based on the voters they lost, that would be terrifying, because far more Democrats defected to vote for Trump than vote for Green or write somebody else in. So here is Joe Biden talking with Jake Tapper. And Biden is a guy who has not ruled himself out for running in 4 years. I think, frankly, he wouldn't have been my pick. Bernie would have been my pick, but I certainly wish that he had run this time. He would have been certainly a much more formidable general election candidate. But I just want to observe, what does he say here about the future leadership of the Democratic Party? And let's measure if the message is being received.
Who is the leader of the Democratic Party as of January 21st?
Like after every presidential election where the party loses, there is no single leader. There are voices that hopefully be heard. Hopefully, I'll be able to have a voice in the direction of the party. The President of the United States will. Obviously, Chuck Schumer will. Obviously, Nancy Pelosi will. There's going to be governors that are going to emerge. And so it's a contest of ideas as to which direction to take the party. After every single loss, when the political party that loses, they go and they do a retrospective. What happened? Where did we make a mistake? What did we do wrong? That debate is going to ensue. And hopefully the party will grow from it.
Chuck Schumer, liberal from New York City, Brooklyn. Nancy Pelosi, liberal, millionaire from San Francisco. Is there a voice that will represent Scranton in there?
I'm not going anywhere. No, I'm really not. I think 2018 is going to be a very good year for the Democrats because now these guys are going to have to say, not generically make America better. Here's how I'm going to make America better. Let's have this debate in ideas.
Republicans control the House. They control the Senate. They will control the White House.
But watch when they do it. Watch the response of the public when they do it. I can hardly wait for these debates.
So, ironically, Joe Biden has moved to the accelerationist position, and he can't wait for the other decimation and a horror show that's going to happen in the next couple of years. He could be right about 18, although the map looks terrible for Democrats. But I also notice, first of all, there isn't much of a change, clearly, in Democratic leadership, because the issue is also just of literally who is on the bench. And then number two, Jake Tapper is talking about Chuck Schumer is a great liberal. If the media narrative in 2016, after everything we have learned from this, for a couple of moments inspiring but overall incredibly disturbing year in politics, the notion that being pro-Wall Street but for marriage equality is sufficient for liberalism and progressivism, that needs to die as a myth. And that's part of the media narrative that needs to change. Joe Biden has a great brand for representing Scranton, and he's done some good things in his career, and he's a likable guy. He's also the one who made horrible offers to Republicans during a grand bargain, and as a senator from Delaware, was essentially a bag man for the credit card industry. I don't know if that really helps people in Scranton. But I will tell you about something that will help anybody. From Scranton to Brooklyn, and that is texture. This time of year, everyone is traveling. There's no way you're going to cram all the magazines you want to read into one carry-on bag. It is. It's a nightmare, especially if you're on a plane, to have like some bag and everybody's waiting behind you and they're glaring while you go through security. And then the people are like, sir, what's inside that bag? And then all of a sudden you realize, wait a second, are there other things besides magazines in that bag? No, I'm just kidding. But now you can with Texture, the app that gives you unlimited access to over 200 magazines. It's incredible. So as an example, I always say that I can read on Texture, and I do Rolling Stone, Fast Company, but also Sports Illustrated, Forbes, Dwell is another magazine I really like looking at. But, you know, alone, Fast Company, Rolling Stone, obviously always want to read Taibbi. It's an incredible resource. Texture has gone beyond delivering just the magazines itself. They've made it easy to find and enjoy the articles you most want to read with daily recommendations, exclusive interactive features, videos, and more. Texture is searchable, and you can mark what you like, check out back issues, view bonus content, and even curate articles and magazines just for you or whoever you're giving texture to this year. Why on earth would you just subscribe to just a couple of magazines when you could have all the best ones on your smartphone or tablet all the time for way less? And right now, Texture is offering my listeners a 14-day free trial. When you go to texture.com/majority, that's Texture, that's a 14-day free trial for Texture. Go to texture.com/majority. 14 days for free. It's an incredible resource. Texture.com/majority. The link is on our blog post. Now, Texture is a great holiday present, but maybe you also have somebody who, in addition to having a voracious mind and wanting to read great magazines, they also have a sweet tooth. Or maybe you want to get something, I guess, kind of explicitly romantic, although it doesn't need to be, but it certainly could be. And that's why I want to talk to you about Shari's Berries. Christmas is next week, and there isn't much time left to shop, wrap, and deliver your gifts. Choose a gift from Shari's Berries, incredible collection of gifts, and go ahead and skip the crowds and hassle all together. No matter who you're shopping for, Shari's Berries is a one-stop shop for everyone on your list, and you don't have to battle the crowds to get the perfect gift. Shop with convenience from your home. I personally, we had Shari's Berries in the office. The chocolate covered strawberries are insanely good. And you know why? It's because the dark chocolate is great, but the strawberry actually tastes really fresh. That's the problem. Mostly when you go for that sort of thing, it gets ruined because the strawberry is like mealy and disgusting. Somehow the freshness of the strawberries preserved with the chocolate, and everybody was in the office. Jerry Seinfeld could have made a lot of French King jokes watching us enjoy our Shari's Berries.
I don't understand that reference, but I do know that it was a very plump strawberry, and it was very good.
It was very, very good. It's an incredible and unique gift that's perfect for sharing, though you may not want to. That is true. I think everybody got pretty greedy with them. And And you get to choose and deliver. Shari's Berries will give your gift fresh and on time, guaranteed. With a Christmas right around the corner, there's only one way to get this amazing $19.99 Shari's Berries deal and help support our show. Just visit sherrysberries.com. Please, berry. That's berries. BERRIES.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and type in my code. And the code is that you have the code? I got it. The code is Majority Report. Shari's Berries has something for everyone and every taste. Again, go to berries.com, click on the microphone, and type in Majority Report. Order them today. There's a link on our website, and you will be addicted to them. Yes. Anything more about the great Shari's Berries?
I just wanted to say that
you guys
were all about the strawberries, which were really good.
They were my favorite.
But they were really chocolatey, too. They were more chocolatey than a lot of chocolate-covered strawberries.
It's big gobs of chocolate on them.
Yeah.
It's a lot, yeah. They nailed it. And also want to tell you about one more sponsor today, Reuters TV. It's a revolutionary video news app for busy people who want to know what on earth is going on. Because we need to know what the hell is going on. Created by the world's largest news organization, Reuters TV is video news as it should be. Not hot air, not talking heads, and no theatrics. It's very important in this environment. We've talked about giving good commentary. Even, you know, the commentary and analysis that we give, we want it to be rooted in empirical facts. You need to have some news sources that will just give it to you straight and directly and give you the sort of raw information and data points you need to navigate the world. It's very important. Other features include a custom news broadcast between 5 and 30 minutes updated throughout the day, scheduled downloads of broadcasts to watch online, live feed of major news events such as presidential debates or press conferences, available on your favorite devices, iOS, Android, Roku, and Apple TV. It's personalized and always up to date. Ready when you are. It's basically the opposite of cable news. Go see for yourself. Go to Reuters.tv/majority. That's Reuters. reuters.com/majority. Link on our website. Two other really quick things. People have been telling me to do for a long time that I need my own website, and now I have it. It is michaeljamalbrooks.com. There's a link to it on our website. I want to thank Rich Hart, who made it for me, and I appreciate it immensely. That's available. And there's a link to it on the website. And fresh Two Dope Boys dropping tomorrow. We'll talk more about that later because we're up against the gun. We'll be right back with Shelley Rigger, Taiwan, China, and Global Crisis on the Majority Report.
Turn some pump to this, nonstop turn on Chris. Out of his mercy. Watch the gentleman ground. Here, Bunch of Antonella. Me all a walk like a champion, talk like a champion. What a piece of money, girl, tell me where you get it from. Tap on your entrance, ram pa pa pam pam. Can't let me in, me got the thing where you a wait on. Walk like a champion, talk like a champion. What a piece of money, girl, how will you get it from. Tap on your entrance, ram pa pa pam pam. Can't let me in, why? Cause we would be more than dead to take your hand and lead it to the promised land. Me 20-foot diamond, all you got to do is be true, so let's go. Fun, satisfying your emotion. At a funny press, instantly she was. She no old and tough, and she no got time or us. Things too down precious, like she never get a cut. Pants on her expand up, back to all and pull up. Giddy up, me up, forget you is a mouse. Think I walk like a champion, act like a champion. What a piece of body can tell me where you get it from. Now find your entrance, ram pa pa pam pam. Can't let me in, me everything. But up on the car, you no look for them way. You look good enough for them. No matter what I can say, put on your clothes, it's like a display. Man, I swear I'll stay about night and day. Could you be my honey and the woman lay lay? With a dad, just smile on her face and say, she want a man for do the work, not one for play. I'm a rotten man, she says she want one for stay. I'm with you while I walk like a champion, talk like a champion. What a piece of body can tell me where you get it from. Not find your entrance, ram pa pa pam pam. Can't let me in, me got the thing where you are weird man. Walk like a champion, talk like a champion. What a piece of body, girl. How will you get it from? Not by your entrance. Ram, pa, pa, pam, pam. Can't let me in. Why? I sing. Oh, man, I want to settle down. Really start a plan to hold you. Look, I come to one conclusion. What? You're supposed to know the work. Supposed to full of action. Music, I'm playing. Your ways are respect. Don't stop sticking just like a time bomb. I do every man want slam. But you want another one. Ram pa pa pam pam, can't let me in. Cry, I'm but you will be more than kind to take your hand and lead you to the promised land. Be 20-foot diamond.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Professor Shelley Rigger. She's a professor of political science at Davidson College. Professor, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So you are an expert in a very complicated, very interesting, and always relevant, but maybe surprisingly in the center of the news cycle, at least last week. Now there's a couple of other kind of fires that have been set off. So we're running a couple of days behind the sort of perpetual motion machine of crisis that the new administration seems to be sort of creating for itself. But I want to start, we're going to get into the background of Taiwan, its position, China's relationship to it, the U.S. policy there. But I think that people have a sense of why the phone call to the Chinese, to the Taiwanese president is important. They might even have a sense of the kind of sensitivities that it evokes. But could you maybe kind of take us deeper into why that phone call raised so many eyebrows and then use that as a kind of a launching point to explain some of the deeper kind of context of how we've gotten to where we are with regards to China and Taiwan today?
Sure. I think the first thing to say is that the phone call itself was not really the problem. On the one hand, it is correct, you know, what everybody reported immediately after, that there's no precedent for a president-elect making a phone call to the Taiwanese president in the last many years. However, I think the strategy behind that phone call was something that we could have a reasonable conversation about, right? So some people who follow this issue closely would say, no, 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 that's a bad idea. But others would say, no, I see why you're going to do that. And the reason why you would do it, you know, the defense of the phone call is Trump is not president yet. And so if he acts consistently with recent and not so recent past procedure, you know, protocol, he's not going to be able to talk to the Taiwanese president once he's inaugurated. So if he's ever going to establish any kind of rapport or relationship with her, it needs to happen between the election and the inauguration. Now, it could have happened before the election. Secretary Clinton apparently did talk to the Taiwanese president, you know, back months and months ago when no one was really paying much attention. But I think you could make the argument that better late than never, that this is an important relationship for the U.S., and that the fact that we have disallowed high-level conversations for the past several decades has made it hard to avoid miscommunication and misunderstanding between the U.S. and this important friend. And so, you know, okay, you can definitely make the case that Trump should have some kind of interaction with the Taiwanese leader before it becomes really inflammatory for him to do so. So to me, you know, that's not really the problem. I understand that some people thought it was a problem, but for me, I could understand why advisors to Trump who really understand what's going on would say you should do it. The problem comes in when they release a press release immediately after the conversation, and people criticized Trump a little bit. It seemed like, I think, to a lot of the media, this is another example of what he's been doing in a sense of talking to national leaders, international leaders, unprepared. You know, I'm thinking of the Pakistani prime minister phone call that got a lot of attention. So they criticized it, and they dropped the Taiwan conversation into the same bucket with some of those others, and they criticized him. And he responded with a series of tweets that took something that might have been strategic and sensible and turned it into a self-inflicted injury. Unfortunately, the injured party is mostly Taiwan, you know, not Donald Trump. And then just to put the period on the end of that sentence, I think he doubled down on this mistake in his Fox News interview this weekend.
Right. So there's a lot there that's kind of fascinating and I think will stick out for people. You've said as an example that we're friends with Taiwan. It's an important relationship, but the contact needs to be made before the inauguration, as an example. Before we get back into the kind of specifics of this wound and how, in fact, it might actually end up hurting Taiwan the most, which is interesting and troubling. Can you explain how we got to the point where we can simultaneously have, and I believe the definition is that we have a something to the effect of we have a friendly relationship with the people of Taiwan. There's some type of diplomatic language around that. In the late 70s, though, we stopped recognizing Taipei as the sort of official capital of China, and we recognized Beijing and the People's Republic of China. Can you explain to us a bit of that history in the sense of how did Taiwan come to be what it is, the origins of that conflict, and then what posture the United States has developed in relationship to that?
Sure, and it is a complicated story, but I think it's one that, you know, makes a certain kind of sense. Mm-hmm. It's probably unique in world history, but here goes. So the Chinese Civil War ended in 1949 with the Communist Party winning victory and establishing the People's Republic of China in the Chinese mainland. But the remnants of the old government, which was Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government with the title of the Republic of China, so People's Republic versus Republic, they wound up on Taiwan. And the People's Republic could not finish the job of wiping out the nationalists, of wiping out the Republic of China. So to this day, the Republic of China exists on Taiwan. It's the same, you know, it's the same constitution, the same government that was used to have all of China back before 1949. And so for a long time, the U.S. said, well, the real China is the one that we recognize, the one in Taiwan, and the communist China is, you know, we're not going to deal with them because they're communist. Then during the 1970s, we made this gradual transition from recognizing the Republic of China on Taiwan to recognizing the People's Republic of China in the mainland. And a condition for that, that the PRC government required, was that the U.S. needed to say, the Republic of China is not a state. So we will only have unofficial relations with the people of Taiwan. And I think that was an acceptable compromise. You know, a lot of people in the U.S. didn't like it. A lot of people in Taiwan really didn't like it. But it was what we needed in order to have a relationship with what has obviously in the intervening decades turned out to be one of the most important countries economically, politically, militarily in the world.
Well,
so the U.S. acknowledged, you know, they said, all right, we're going to break relations with Taiwan. We're not going to call Taiwan a state, but we're going to continue to have all kinds of unofficial relations with Taiwan, and that is even going to extend to selling arms to the Taiwan military. So it is a very, very robust relationship that the U.S. has with Taiwan, but it takes this very unusual form, which is unofficial ties.
Friends with benefits. I think that I think that that's, I mean, and I'm glad you mentioned that because I wanted to be really clear that this isn't just sort of a diplomatic nicety in the kind of midst of this sort of interesting balancing act. We're still invested significantly in Taiwan, including on the level of selling them arms, in fact, which I'm glad you pointed out. So then that kind of brings up another sort of interesting parallel track, which I would really like you to comment on, and correct me if I'm wrong. The other thing about the sort of Taiwan piece, one is Taiwan and how it's evolved as a state, and then the other is the domestic politics. For many years, and I would say obviously not just during the 70s when Nixon went to China, and I guess in, you know, quote unquote mainstream Republican foreign policy thinking kind of went along with the pivot, and you know there's the reality of mainland China as an incredibly important global player because of its history, size, and everything else. But Taiwan was also for many years, going back to the 40s, obviously, but I think even through the 90s, arguably, and maybe even through today, because you know we see with Bob Dole's, you know, lobbying contract for the Taiwanese government, it was also a signifier in American politics of staunch anti-communism. And, you know, Madam Chiang Kai-shek, who was, you know, as you said, the general who Mao defeated and fled Taiwan, she ended up, I believe, living in the United States. I think she died, and she was on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I think she died, like, not terribly long ago. So right. There is that aspect, and this was a kind of funny irony of how this story showed up, where it almost also seemed like, okay, it's, you know, it's Trump kind of freelancing and then getting provoked by China, which we'll talk about later because China kind of offered him an out, but it ended up offending him. But it also was, seemed to be another callback to this other sort of tribal American conservative principle about Taiwan. I'll get to the question about Taiwan in a second. I'm wondering if you could comment on that first.
Well, you know, I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is, yes, absolutely, there's a long history of a kind of staunch anti-communist faction in U.S. politics being particularly sensitive to the need to kind of take care of Taiwan, but they have been at least supplemented, and I would say really overtaken, by another set of voices which say, look, Taiwan is the best example of a country that did exactly what the U.S. was asking during the Cold War. It was, under Chiang Kai-shek, a single-party, right-wing, authoritarian state with tons of human rights abuses and all that stuff, and it made a peaceful and bloodless transition to full-on liberal democracy all by itself, even with all of this overhang of tension with the People's Republic of China and so on. Taiwan managed to become a democracy, and it's functioning as a democracy. So for a lot of us, I think one of the reasons that the U.S. needs to attend to Taiwan and to recognize the value of Taiwan is that it is an example, one of a shrinking number of examples in the world today, of the possibility of a country bringing its people peace, freedom, prosperity, democracy in a very stable, sort of gradual and positive way. So that's another reason that a lot of the folks advising Trump and also some who are not advising Trump have said, we need to continue to take care of Taiwan. It's not just about the economics. It's not just about the anti-China. It's for many people primarily about a democracy, a country that did what we asked, and
can we
pull the rug out from under them now.
Can we actually go into that with a bit more detail? I mean, I do want, and I guess obviously the political leanings of this show are clear, but that's actually really fascinating, because not only, and I do want you to elaborate on that, not only has Taiwan made that transition, and this is another kind of irony of the sort of political symmetry of the Trump call, I would like you to talk a little bit about Taiwan's current president, because not only have they evolved into a liberal democracy, it's pretty two-party dominated with a right-wing party that is sort of the reformed remnants of the old regime, and then a kind of center-left party, which the current president represents. In this process, not only has Taiwan turned into a democracy, it's arguably one with some pretty progressive leanings. It's probably one of the most progressive countries in Asia. So maybe you could talk about that and the current president specifically. She's an interesting figure.
Sure. Yeah. So Taiwan started to move in this democratic direction. Really, there were people who were advocating, of course, for political change all from the very beginning. Even back before the Civil War, there were people who got in trouble in China for being Democrats. But the movement for democracy really got started in Taiwan in the 70s, and the agenda was always kind of twofold. On the one hand, people in the democratic movement wanted the political institutions, which actually were already in their constitution, right? So the ROC constitution, the Republic of China constitution, is a very democratic, it sets up a liberal democracy. So it was suspended for many years because of the Civil War. So they wanted the Constitution to be implemented and democracy to really happen. And they also wanted the ethnic majority on Taiwan, which were people who had already been there for a long time before the Chinese Civil War, to actually be fully represented in the government. Because the government, during the authoritarian period, was dominated by people who came to Taiwan only at the end of the Civil War, or during and after the Civil War. Taiwan had been a Japanese colony from 1895 until the end of World War II, so the Republic of China kind of came in there and took it over from the Japanese and put people who had just come from mainland China in charge of everything. So the democratic movement in Taiwan was both a movement for democracy and a movement for justice for the majority of Taiwanese who wanted to be fully represented in politics and society. So they've always been, they call the main opposition party that was formed in 1986 is called the Democratic Progressive Party. Mm-hmm. And while there's always been tension within the Democratic Progressive Party between a more sort of pro-business conservative wing on economic issues and a more kind of social democratic wing, the party is certainly more sensitive to the needs of workers, much more attuned to the environment, and currently much more oriented toward kind of post-materialist values than the old Nationalist Party, which continues, as you said, to be the kind of conservative remnant of Chiang Kai-shek's party. So, for example, one of the issues that's getting Taiwan a lot of attention right now, or was before Donald Trump took to Twitter, was marriage equality.
Right.
And it is entirely possible. It's not a done deal yet, as far as I know, but it is entirely possible that Taiwan will be the first country in the region to, you know, to have marriage equality,
right.
Which really is extraordinary. And it has had a very vibrant and really wonderful LGBTQ movement for a long time. And, you know, they've made the kind of, they've done the work to convince the society to embrace LGBT people. So it's not like, you know, in the U.S. sometimes people say, well, you shouldn't impose these things through court order. We could argue about that on a different day. But in Taiwan, if they get marriage equality, it'll be because it passes in their legislature, because it's, you know, the democratic preference of the Taiwanese people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something I think a lot of Taiwan watchers in the U.S. really don't want the U.S. to trade away to China, you know, for stuff that's of short-term benefit.
So let's
at a long-term cost.
Let's get to the bigger, that sort of global, that broader dimension in a second. But just give us, in the context of what you were just saying, give us, you know, a brief summary of Taiwan's president, including, I realize, her name. We've referenced her several times without actually saying who she is.
Right. Her name is Tsai Ing-wen, and she is she's a woman in her 60s. She had a career as a lawyer and a trade negotiator. She's had a lot of different government posts over the years. She's very smart, like crazy smart.
Like
she
Trump.
Has degrees.
I'm sorry.
Not like him.
Okay. All right.
I think she is smart in a very different way. She's not necessarily.
I just have to say, Professor, that was masterful professor work right there.
Well,
smart in a different way. Okay.
Yeah. Smart in a good way. Yeah. So
she has a good brain.
She was a presidential candidate in 2012, and she didn't win, mainly because she couldn't convince the voters in Taiwan that she had a good plan for dealing with mainland China, because that's a big problem for Taiwan, is to, you know, figure out how to live next door to this very large and powerful country that would like to absorb Taiwan.
Right.
So how do you deal with them? And I don't think in 2012 she had a good answer to that. And she spent the years from 2012 to 2016 trying to figure out how to preserve Taiwan as a free and autonomous democratic state while at the same time having a good relationship with the People's Republic of China. And she also spent a lot of time trying to mend fences with officials in the U.S. who had also been unconvinced in 2012 by her approach to mainland policy. And she succeeded at both of those things. So when she was elected president in 2016, it was because the electorate really bought what she was offering, which was to try to keep things steady with the mainland, not give any more than she absolutely had to, but also not provoke or, you know, rock the boat. And that was acceptable to her own voters. And it was also, I think, very well received in Washington as officials of the U.S. government looked at it and said, you know, she's steady as she goes. It's gonna be fine.
So,
and so that's how I would kind of summarize Tsai Ing-wen.
So you have an impressive leader and really an impressive country.
Yes.
When you talk about China wanting to reabsorb Taiwan, is this in the and then we'll talk about what a non-inflammatory U.S. policy could be, or continuing U.S. policy in a way that maintains this balance without selling Taiwan out. But when you talk about China's posture, is it a certainty that China wants? I mean, I understand in a quote-unquote ideal world for the People's Republic of China, they would like to reabsorb Taiwan. But is their reaction and their posture to this call, is it that they are actually going to are planning and hoping to take a more aggressive approach to Taiwan as part of a kind of broader assertion of China's reemergence, certainly in its own neighborhood? Or are they more concerned that this call and that sort of disruption of diplomatic nicety, what that does for the U.S.-China relationship, looking at it from China's viewpoint, what is their angle here?
Yeah. So, first of all, you know, the thing that they need most acutely is for Taiwan not to move away from a relationship with China. So they know that actually negotiating or imposing some kind of what they call reunification, although I think it's important to point out that, you know, Taiwan has never been part of the People's Republic of China. It was founded after the Republic of China moved to Taiwan. So it's not exactly reunification. And in fact, when they speak about this in Chinese, they say unification, not re. But at any rate, you know, that's all the sort of thing that we professors quibble over. But ideally, we would be moving toward some kind of unification, and it doesn't necessarily have to be Taiwan becomes a province of the PRC. You know, they're willing to be flexible about
what
exactly that
looks like.
Would it be like
a Hong Kong type
of
thing?
Yeah, in fact, the Hong Kong deal was created as a sort of trial run for what they might do with Taiwan, although that hasn't worked out great either.
Right.
But what they really need urgently is for Taiwan not to move away and not to move in the direction of basically saying, you know, we've been separated now since 1949. We're just going to go ahead and file for divorce. Because as long as there's no divorce paper out there, right, there's the possibility of reconciliation. And I think for the PRC, what they really, really need is for the possibility of reconciliation to be on the table. So that's what their bottom line, is that Taiwan cannot, in effect, file for divorce. So what they want from the U.S. is they want the U.S. not to encourage Taiwan to move in the direction of what we would call formal or legal independence, which is what I mean by serving divorce papers. So every U.S. president since Nixon, but certainly since Carter, has sent the message to Taiwan that, you know, you can continue as you are if you can figure that out for yourself and you can figure that out with China, but we're not going to help you extricate yourself. You know, we're not going to write up those divorce papers and serve them to Beijing. So when a U.S. official does anything that's out of the normal script, the PRC starts to wonder. So are they changing direction? Has the U.S. decided that an independent Taiwan, one which is, you know, allied with the U.S., is actually something that Washington is willing to either accept or even promote?
So,
and I think that's where this whole brouhaha comes in, is, you know, Trump seems to be saying, whether or not I continue with the longstanding position that, you know, the U.S. is not for Taiwan independence, is uncertain, and that I think is making them very nervous.
So, and that's why it could end up hurting Taiwan the most, because if that is sort of overcorrected for by the incoming administration, that might sort of end up sort of hurting Taiwan's position. And in a certain sense, my speculation would be, in a certain ways, it seems like the status quo kind of benefits Taiwan to the extent that if they're not directly provoking the PRC on the level of actually leaving and undermining them in that way and officially declaring independence, they can sort of maintain this distinct system. But then as an example, when you say close relations, that's like a trade relationship with China. I mean, there's a lot of commerce. Right. There's other – these are not – it's a very distinct situation because in some ways there's very kind of enhanced and healthy relations between the two. So as a final question, what would that U.S. posture be to not alienate China, to not sort of provoke a situation, but maintain a certain protective umbrella over Taiwan and its autonomy and the success of its project? What does that balance look like? Is it actually more of the same? Is it a pretty good policy that we've developed? Or do we need to revamp it or adjust it?
Okay. First of all, it means not weaponizing Taiwan against the PRC, which is something that I have worried about for years, honestly, with Republican administrations, because Republican administrations have, and Democrats too. I mean, you could say the same thing about Bill Clinton, actually. A lot of U.S. presidential candidates, they think, we got to do something about China. You know, we got to get tough on China. Mm-hmm. And they talk tough on China, and they suck Taiwan into that because they think, well, Taiwan is something that is, it's a policy area that the U.S. has that the PRC doesn't like. Right. So we should change our Taiwan policy too. And then they get into office and they realize, whoa, there is a lot at stake here. This is a really important policy area, and they back off. And so, you know, Bill Clinton stopped decrying the butchers of Beijing. Mm-hmm. George W. Bush once said memorably, the U.S. will do whatever it takes to help Taiwan. And then, you know, he ended up really at the far other end of the spectrum on Taiwan policy later on. So, you know, it's a temptation to say, well, this is something that we do that the Chinese don't like, so let's do more of it as a way of, cracking down on China or sending a message to China. So number one, don't weaponize Taiwan. Taiwan is, its people have a right to be treated as an end in themselves, not to the means of the end of someone who wants to complicate the life of Beijing's leaders, right? So if Taiwanese people choose to challenge, provoke Beijing, that's one thing. But for the U.S. to put Taiwan in that position, to load them into a barrel of a gun and fire, is just so wrong. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. Don't weaponize Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Number two, don't turn Taiwan into a bargaining chip to get North Korea. I was just really aghast to read Trump's comments to Fox News this weekend where he said, you know, why would I decide what my Taiwan policy is going to be? Or why would I agree to this one China thing if I haven't gotten anything for it? So what he's saying is I'm going to step back from what my predecessor did, and if I get something from China, then I'll go back to where Obama is. So I can see how someone might say, well, that's not making a bargaining chip out of Taiwan. But I just think as soon as you make Taiwan part of a transactional foreign policy that says, I want this and this and this from China, you want this, Taiwan, from the U.S., so let's make a deal, then, you know, you are absolutely using Taiwan as a bargaining chip, which is, again, just incredibly wrong. It's bad foreign policy, and it's just immoral, you know? It's the wrong thing to do.
Well, Professor, that's as good a place as any to leave it. I really appreciate your time. Professor Shelley Rigger, Professor of Political Science at Davidson College. and many books and publications on Taiwan and the region. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, everybody. We are going to get to the fun half. You can join us at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Hopefully you're not the first caller that we always miss for whatever reason. The IMs are open. You can become a member of the Majority Report today at majority.fm/become a member. I also believe there's a site, I think, called Cuck Nation. Is it cucknation.org, where you can buy a gift of the Majority Report for someone else? Subscribe to our Majority Report YouTube channel. If you're not on, or if you're new to Twitter, follow us at majority.fm on Twitter and follow each of us individually. Like us on Facebook. Constant new content getting updated regularly. Write us a review on iTunes. That helps get more eyeballs in front of the show. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. On Two Dope Boys in a Podcast, we're at 131 reviews, so thank you if you're also a listener to that show and you're making those reviews happen.
Let's get to 150 by Christmas. So we need 19 people to get on it. So if you're one of those people who haven't written a review yet,
yeah, get on it. Thank you. I like that, Matt. MichaelJamalBrooks.com. If you want to check it out, I finally have a website up. A lot to get to in the fun half. We will see you on the flip side. If you're signing off for now, see you tomorrow. That's hilarious.